our last chance to save humanity.
2-degree warming would mean that we will get sea level rise of several meters, which would have disastrous consequences.
That's climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. We spend the hour with him today on Writer's Voice. He taught Al Gore about climate change. The Bush administration tried to muzzle him to keep him from saying that humans were the cause behind global warming. And he's one of the first to sound the alarm that climate change is real and threatens life as we know it on planet Earth. We're talking, of course, about Dr. James Hansen. One of the leading climatologists in the world today, he was named in 2006 by Time magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people. Now Hansen's come out with a new book that calls global warming a generational crime, Storms of My Grandchildren. Hansen says that we can get off fossil fuels and we must phase out coal by 2020, lest the Earth warm to a level it hasn't seen for 55 million years, when the ice sheets were gone and crocodiles frolicked at the North Pole. James Hansen heads the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City, a position he's held since 1981. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. First, Jim Hansen, I want to give you a very warm welcome to Writer's Voice. You've long been a hero to me, actually, for your courage in standing up to the attempts to censor you in the Bush administration and for your principled stand on the science.
Well, thanks very much.
And now you have written this terrific book with my favorite climate-related word in it, grandchildren.
Yeah, that's what it's really all about.
I heard you say on another radio interview that you were pleased with what came out of the climate talks at Copenhagen, yet there was no accord or even a firm mandated target set there. What's there to like about Copenhagen?
Well, what's to like is the fact that they did not go down the path of cap and trade with offsets, which is a bogus solution, analogous to what was done with the Kyoto Protocol, which did not reduce global emissions at all. In fact, it caused them to accelerate. And the same thing would happen now if we continued with that type of agreement. We have to get honest about the problem and what is needed in order to solve it.
Did you actually see anything there that was an alternative to cap and trade?
Well, you know, what happens in the United States, I think, is key to what happens in the rest of the world. And we're having discussions now in the government, which so far this year have been discouraging in that they're completely driven by the special interests in Washington. The Waxman-Markey bill in the House, and then the Boxer-Kerry bill in the Senate are, in fact, the cap-and-trade with offsets approach, in which the rights to pollute will nominally be auctioned to those companies or people who want to have the right to emit carbon dioxide. But even the money that is collected that way would basically be given back to polluters or invested in things that the government thinks are useful, like clean coal. It just doesn't make sense. It will cause the price of energy to go up, but it won't reduce the emissions because there are also these offsets, which are ways in which you can nominally reduce your emissions by purchasing additional rights, which are mostly bogus. It's a very complicated arrangement, and that's part of the problem. What you really need is an honest approach in which you say that as long as fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, they will continue to be burned, and even at increasing rates. And therefore, the way to address the problem is to put a price on carbon emissions. And the way you would do that to make it fair and not give anybody an advantage is collect the money from the fossil fuel companies at the mine or the port of entry, just a flat fee. And all of the money that's collected should be given to the public rather than to special interests. That would be a very simple procedure. For example,
you mean in a form of a rebate of some kind at the end of the year or at the end of the month?
You could make it a monthly deposit to people's bank account, or if they don't have a bank account, to their debit card. So, for example, by the time the fee has risen to $115 per ton of carbon dioxide, which is equivalent to $1 a gallon on gasoline, at the rate of coal, oil, and gas used last year in the United States, that would raise $670 billion, which is a lot of money. It's $3,000 for every legal adult resident in the country. And with half a share for children, up to two per family, that's $9,000 per family with two or more children. It's a lot of money. It's enough to discourage the use of fossil fuels, to encourage alternatives, more efficient use of energy and renewable energies, energies that do not produce this pollution, and yet it gives the public the money that they need in order to reduce their carbon emissions, to next time they buy a vehicle, to get a more efficient one, or to insulate their homes, and it would stimulate the economy.
Right, I was going
to
say,
that's the kind of thing we need, not only to solve the climate problem, but to solve our addiction to fossil fuels, which is important for national security and for the health of people through the air pollution and water pollution. So there are a lot of reasons to phase off our dependence on fossil fuels.
Well, you've covered a lot of exciting and interesting territory here. Just in that answer, the idea of rebates, of going right back to the consumer, hopefully to be used for more efficient technologies. But right after Copenhagen, the price of carbon that you talk about has actually dropped something on the order of 13% over the course of the talks and just after. So
yeah, that's exactly what the point I'm trying to make. You see, that's because they're trying this cap-and-trade approach in Europe. It's the price just fluctuates up and down. So, you know, when I wrote an op-ed on this topic, I titled it Goldman Sachs Cap-and-Trade, because this cap-and-trade scheme is a scheme that was hatched in part by the because of the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. They like the idea of a trading scheme. You try to put a cap on the quantity and then trade the rights to pollute. But who makes money on that? It's the big banks, the traders that are planning on making big money. And where does the money come from? The government doesn't run a printing press for this. It will come from the public, of course, through increased energy prices. So that's why we need a simple, honest approach in which we put the fee on the fossil fuels. We know exactly how much we've collected, and we delivered 100% of that to the public instead of to the big banks.
A lot of people say the cap and trade worked to decrease the sulfur in the atmosphere that causes acid rain. What's the difference here?
In fact, it didn't really work very well for that, but to the extent that it did, it was mandated that the sulfur emissions from power plants should be reduced 50%. And that could be done by whichever power plants could do it most efficiently. And that did result in a nearly 50% reduction in sulfur emissions, but the solution was simply to substitute low-sulfur Wyoming coal for West Virginia or Eastern high-sulfur coal. And that's a very special situation and actually was not all that effective in the sense that a cap-and-trade approach also places a floor on the emissions. So the emissions were only reduced by half. Additional reductions would have been at a value 25 times greater than the cost, but no greater reductions occurred because the cap was 50%. Well, in principle, you could make the cap lower, but you'd have to pass a new law, and that's not easy to do. What you actually want is a system that will pass tipping points so that as the price of carbon rises, alternative forms of energy, whether energy efficiency or different types of renewable energy, such as solar or wind, or nuclear power, or anything that does not produce the pollution, becomes cheaper than the fossil fuel, then it will rapidly take over the market, and the price will go down further because of the economies of scale.
So
that's what we can get with a fee and dividend type approach.
So you're actually saying, you're not against the market per se, but you're saying it needs to be front-loaded by a firm price being put on carbon so that the market can actually reflect the true cost of carbon emissions. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. At present, we're actually subsidizing fossil fuels, and we do not make them pay for the damage that they do to human health through air pollution, water pollution. You know, the pollutants you hear about, mercury and arsenic, these are coming mainly from fossil fuels. But the fossil fuel price does not reflect that. Those costs are just added to the public's burden.
The target for global warming that was set at Copenhagen was a rise of 2 degrees Celsius. What do you think of that target?
Well, we know that that's a disaster scenario. So far, we've had a rise in temperature of 0.8 degrees Celsius. And we already see that the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are not going to be stable on the long run. The rate at which Greenland is losing ice accelerated from 150 cubic kilometers several years ago to 300 cubic kilometers per year now, and likewise Antarctic rate of ice loss has accelerated. 2 degree warming would mean that those ice sheets are unstable and we will get sea level rise of several meters, which would have disastrous consequences. And we would also lose all the mountain glaciers around the world, which provide fresh water for actually billions of people from the rivers that originate in the mountains. And the expansion of the subtropics, which we can already see is affecting the southwest United States and causing the lakes to run dry and forest fires to increase. The stress we're putting on coral reefs, for example, the Arctic sea ice would all be gone with the effects that would have on wildlife there and indigenous peoples. So we really, what we've learned in the last few years is that to stabilize climate at a level that allows the species that we now have on the planet to continue to exist is going to require that we stabilize carbon dioxide at a level of no more than 350 parts per million. And that would be possible if we phase out coal use over the next few decades and if we prohibit unconventional fossil fuels. But in fact, what we see is that governments are allowing continued expansion of coal use and even beginning to use these unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands.
We're talking with the eminent climate scientist Jim Hansen. His book is Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. One thing that seems striking to me is that there's an awful lot of talk about how climate change is going to affect those people over there. It'll affect Africa. It will affect Bangladesh. And of course, those are terrible things. But there seems to be an assumption that it's not going to be affecting us here at home. What kind of sea level rise are we likely to see here in the U.S., especially on the East Coast?
That depends on what time scale we refer to, but that's why I'm concerned particularly about my children and grandchildren, because we can see very well what is going to happen as warming continues and as the ice sheets become more and more unstable. Because what happens is, as the rate of discharge of these icebergs to the ocean increases, we will reach a level at which they begin to cool the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. And as the low latitudes continue to get warmer, this increased temperature gradient from the low latitudes to the high latitudes will drive stronger frontal or cyclonic storms, which in extreme cases generate winds comparable to that in hurricanes. When you combine these stronger storms with the rising sea level, we're going to get disasters at coastal cities all along the United States coast and other coastlines, which, because of the populations, I mean, we had a disaster at New Orleans, but that's a relatively small city. Once we start to have storms with storm tides and increasing sea level on large cities, we're going to have social and economic disasters associated with that, which will make New Orleans look like a small thing in comparison.
Yes, I was reading, now this was a two-year-old report, but I was reading a report about preparedness, hurricane preparedness in New York. Somebody there said, if you're not wealthy and you don't have a car, basically you won't be able to get out of the city.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you see, the thing is, it won't require a hurricane. Once you get a nor'easter with rising sea level and with increasing strength in these mid-latitude frontal storms, then you can get a comparable response without an actual hurricane.
Well, you talk about the loading the dice as a metaphor. What is the relationship between that and the frequency of these storms?
Well, I used the dice to illustrate the fact that although natural fluctuations are as yet still larger than the mean rise in temperature, but the perceptive person can notice that the frequency of unusually warm seasons is already beginning to increase. The dice are loaded. The same applies to extremes of the hydrologic cycle. By that I mean, on the one extreme, heavy rainfalls and floods, and on the other extreme, heat waves and droughts. Because as the world gets warmer, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. That means that when you do have rainfall, you can get heavier rainfall and bigger floods. But at the times and places when it's dry, because of the increased temperature, you get greater drying and higher temperatures. And we can see that the dice are already beginning to be loaded. For example, where I live, we've had two so-called 100-year floods in the last 15 years. And that's the kind of loading of the dice that is going to occur as we continue to push the climate to the more extreme global warming.
You give really what you say is a short course in climatology. We don't have time to go into the kind of detail that you did in the book, which is fascinating, but can you give us some of the highlights of that so that we can understand what are some of the issues here and be able to be more intelligent when people who deny that there's climate change come back with their arguments?
What I've tried to do is, in each chapter, include a modest amount of science, including, in some cases, one or two graphs, just to show what is happening. And I also point out that I am going to include these graphs and some others that help people understand climate change on my Columbia University website. So I do think you're right that we have to try to get the public to understand what is happening and see that things are changing along the direction that is expected, because the fundamental thing about climate is the inertia of the system, which is easy to understand because the ocean is 4 kilometers, about 2.5 miles deep. The ice sheets are a couple of miles thick. These things do not change immediately as you begin to apply a forcing to them. And by a forcing, I mean something that alters the planet's energy balance. So, for example, if we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that reduces the heat radiation that the planet is emitting to space, because it's like a blanket on the Earth. So it keeps the heat more effectively at the Earth's surface. And that radiation imbalance then causes the ocean to begin to get warmer. As the ocean gets warmer, it melts the ice shelves, which are the tongues of ice that come out from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet into the ocean. As the ice sheets begin to melt, that allows the ice streams, the more plastic part of the ice sheets, to begin to discharge their icebergs to the ocean more rapidly. And so this all takes time because the ocean, you know, just as your swimming pool doesn't warm up immediately when the sun comes up, it takes a time to absorb the energy and get warmer. But we see this happening. We see the deep ocean getting warmer. We see the ice streams beginning to move faster. They're discharging icebergs more than twice as fast as they were just 10 years ago. So that's the nature. That's why the problem is an intergenerational issue. We are the ones adding the gases to the atmosphere that cause these processes to get started. But it's our children and grandchildren who will bear the brunt of the problem. And that's why it's an issue of intergenerational inequity. It's one that we didn't understand when our parents were beginning the heavy fossil fuel use. They didn't realize that they were going to cause problems for future generations. But now the picture has become clear. We realize that we are causing problems for our children and grandchildren if we don't get on a different path. And that's why we have to begin to address it now. The truth is, the things that we need to do make sense for other reasons. Why should we continue to go after the last drops of oil on the Earth and exploit these really dirty, unconventional fossil fuels when they wouldn't last indefinitely anyhow? We're going to need to move on to cleaner energies. So why not do it now and preserve a planet and allow the other species to continue to exist, rather than trying to get the last drop of these fossil fuels?
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. When you say that this takes a long time to unfold, you also point in the book that it's taking an awful lot shorter time than other climate change events in the Earth's history, because, of course, a lot of the climate deniers say, well, Earth has warmed up before, and it's been just peachy. Literally peachy. We can have peaches in New England, which actually we're already beginning to be able to grow here and to have. So explain about these timelines that you say in the book we're doing this about 10,000 times more powerful. The human changes are 10,000 times more powerful than natural climate forcings. So if this is a long time, how come it's so short?
Yeah, well, it's certainly true. There have been huge climate changes in the Earth's history. If we go back 50 million years, there was no ice on the planet. It was much warmer. Sea level was 75 meters, about almost 250 feet higher than it is now. And, of course, that if you got to that situation, it would be pretty stable. But to get there from here would, of course, flood billions of people out of their homes. And we have lived in a climate, the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, in which the climate has been relatively stable with sea level at the level it is now. And, yeah, the rate at which we are changing carbon dioxide is about 10,000 times faster than the natural rates of increase or decrease that gave rise to these very large but slow changes of the climate during the Earth's history. And, of course, if we civilization developed with the climate that we've had during the last 10,000 years, and unless we want enormous disruptions to civilization, we need to keep the climate roughly within that range that has existed during the last 10,000 years.
We're speaking with Dr. James Hansen about climate change. He's one of the world's foremost climate scientists, and he's just come out with a new book called Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent, la mer des reflets changeants sous la pluie, la mer.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Just before the break, climate scientist James Hansen was telling us about the catastrophic consequences if we let the planet's atmosphere warm by 2 degrees centigrade. That's currently seen as an acceptable level of warming by the world's political leaders. Hansen says that would raise sea levels by over 6 feet, thereby flooding most coastal cities and destroy glaciers that supply water to billions. But his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, imagines an even more terrifying scenario, a runaway greenhouse effect that would leave the Earth lifeless. He says that could come about because of feedbacks in the climate that would keep amplifying global warming. I asked Hansen to explain how this feedback process works and how it could lead to a Venus Earth.
Yeah, well, of course, it's well known, I think, to many people, it's easy for people to understand that there is a limited range of distances from the sun at which you can have a planet that has life on it, at a planet that has liquid water on the surface. If you go further away from the sun, it becomes too cold, and any water would be in the form of ice. That's, of course, the case with Mars. Mars has plenty of water, but it's frozen as ice. If you go closer to the sun, then it becomes too hot. The water evaporates or boils into the atmosphere, and you get a runaway greenhouse effect, as has occurred on Venus. At one time, when earlier in the history of the solar system, when the sun was dimmer, Venus did have liquid oceans, but as the sun slowly got brighter, you know, 4 billion years ago, the sun was about 30% dimmer than it is now. And it's burning hydrogen at the sun's core by nuclear fusion to form helium, but that releases the energy which causes the sun to have its brightness, but it's slowly getting brighter over time. And as that happened, Venus became warmer and warmer and experienced this runaway greenhouse effect, which then caused not only the water vapor to be in the atmosphere, but the carbon dioxide. It just baked the carbon dioxide out of the surface rocks. Well, there's nothing magic that keeps the Earth within this belt of distances from the sun where you can have liquid water. In fact, when I was a postdoc, it was a puzzle for scientists to try to understand why did the Earth never freeze over, because it seemed that with the dimmer sun earlier in the Earth's history, you would have expected the Earth to freeze over. In fact, what was realized just in the last 15 years is that indeed that did occur several times. As the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere fluctuated, at times when it was low, the planet actually froze over all the way to the equator. The last time was about 680 million years ago. But as the sun became brighter, at that time the sun was about 6% dimmer than what it is now. But as the sun got brighter, the Earth has been stable in the zone where you have liquid water on the surface. But eventually, in about 5 billion years, when the sun gets much brighter, the Earth would go to the runaway greenhouse effect. But it's possible for that to happen much sooner if we continue to increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And as I point out in the chapter titled in the section in the year 2525, if we burn all the fossil fuels and the unconventional fossil fuels, which would cause eventually the methane hydrates to melt, that's the frozen methane in the tundra in the high latitudes and the methane in the continental shelves, cause that to get into the atmosphere, then we would almost certainly get a runaway greenhouse effect, and it would, of course, destroy all species on the planet, including humans.
Isn't that already happening? I mean, isn't methane already being released from the tundra?
Yeah, there's a modest amount coming out from the tundra. That's one of the signs. It's one of the things we have to keep our eye on. But we're a long way still from the runaway greenhouse effect. And because of the time it takes the ocean to warm up and the ice sheets to melt, it's not something that's going to happen in our lifetime. But on the time scale of several centuries, it could happen. And in the book, I try to describe this by a little science fiction section in which I describe the people from the planet Clairon, which is a planet that was in a solar system similar to that with a sun that's similar to our sun, but at a more advanced stage where it was moving toward the red giant phase, and so it was going to cause that planet to have a runaway greenhouse effect. So they looked for another planet where they could escape to, and they discovered this marvelous planet Earth, which had even more species than on their planet, and remarkable species. And this was a very advanced civilization. So they were able to send a spacecraft to the Earth. But unfortunately, when they arrived in year 2525, they found that Earth had begun to look like Venus, and they had to land on Mars instead of on the Earth. And what they found on Mars was the failed attempts of Americans and Chinese and Japanese and Europeans to try to establish colonies on Mars to escape the Earth as it was moving into the runaway greenhouse effect. What humans found was that life is very complex. We could not even transplant a species such as the monarch butterfly. It's just far too complicated for humans to understand all the life processes well enough to transfer our life to a place like Mars. So the bottom line is we'd better try to protect the planet that we have.
You also say that we could actually, it's possible to do some things that will create negative feedbacks instead of these positive feedbacks that just make it worse and worse and worse.
All feedbacks work in both directions. If you reduce the forcing, the feedback works in the other direction. A feedback amplifies the effect of whatever forcing you introduce. So if we decrease the amount of CO2 from the present 387 back toward 350, then the feedbacks actually work to help amplify the change in the cooling direction. So we could stabilize the climate, but it requires that the level of the forcing mechanism be the appropriate level for the climate state that we want, which is presumably the one that we've had for the last 10,000 years.
Yeah. And so now we do come to coal. You say we need to keep all the coal in the ground. What you're saying is we need to stop coal now, and
yeah,
we need a
yeah.
transition period to get rid, you know, to stop using oil and gas.
Yeah, well, the reason is, first of all, there's more coal. There's more carbon in coal than there is in oil and gas. And the oil and gas are very convenient fuels, which are limited in amount. We've used about half of the oil that we know about. And it's very difficult to see how we could prevent the use of the readily available oil and gas. It's owned by countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia. But coal is not only has the most carbon dioxide, but it's also the dirtiest fuel. It's the one that we could decide to leave in the ground or to use it only at power plants where we capture the CO2 and put it back in the ground. But it just doesn't look like that's economically or practically workable. So it's clear, unless you're going to tell, you know, I met with the environment minister of Germany after I'd written a letter to the chancellor, and they agreed that we would have to limit the CO2 emissions and try to get CO2 back below 350 parts per million. But at the same time, they're planning to build more coal plants. And my question then was, well, then how are you going to convince Russia to leave its oil in the ground, its gas in the ground, and how to convince Saudi Arabia to leave its oil in the ground? And of course, there is no prospect for doing that. So the only practical way to keep CO2 at a level that allows our climate to stay close to what it is now is to phase out coal use. And that's the dirtiest fossil fuel. It's the cause of a lot of problems. The mercury that makes it impractical for us to eat many of the fish that are now caught in the ocean, and the arsenic, asthma problems, many health problems associated with the coal. So it simply doesn't make sense to continue to rely on that. Since it's a finite resource anyway, we need to move on to the era beyond fossil fuels.
And moving beyond those fossil fuels, you know, a lot of people say that we could deploy enough wind energy to supply all of the energy needs of the United States, particularly if we cut, if we increased efficiencies. But you're not so sanguine about sun and wind. You actually, you're probably getting a fair number of environmentalists a little upset because you're saying that only nuclear power can really, that robust transition fuel. Why do you take that point of view, and what kind of reactors are you talking about?
Well, I would say a little differently than that. I make clear that the highest priority should be given to energy efficiency. We can reduce our total energy use by something of the order of 50% if we use the energy more efficiently. And second priority should be the renewable energies. But it is clear all of the energy, the utility executives that I have met with say that they need, in addition to renewable energies, they need baseload electric power, which they can get either from coal or nuclear power. There's nothing else that exists at this time that can provide that.
And what is that? Tell our listeners what baseload means.
baseload means the kind of continuous energy source that can be provided by burning a fossil fuel, for example, or from by burning a nuclear fuel. But wind and the sun are intermittent. And at this time, they're also more expensive. But, you know, those places that can get along with just improved energy efficiency and renewable energies, that's fine. But there are many places, especially China and India, which get about 90% of their electricity from burning coal, that the sun and wind are simply not going to provide the kind of energies that they need. And I was never a supporter of nuclear partly because of the nuclear waste problem, but also because of the finite amount of uranium. But what has changed the picture is the development of the possibility of fourth-generation nuclear power. The current nuclear reactors, are second generation. And an additional problem with them is that their safety depends upon the human factor. If you're not careful, if there's an anomaly in a nuclear reactor, it requires a human to turn it off. But the newest light water reactors, which are the kind that is used now, are inherently safer. They're designed so that if there's an anomaly, they shut down automatically. So that partially improves the status of nuclear power, but what really makes a difference is the fact that there is a technology that is on the verge of being available. That's the fourth generation reactors, which are fundamentally different than the prior generations in that, for one thing, they allow you to burn all of the nuclear fuel. The current generations burn less than 1% of the energy in the uranium. A fourth-generation reactor uses more than 99%. And furthermore, it can burn nuclear waste. So it can be our solution to the waste problem. Rather than trying to store the waste for 10,000 or 100,000 years in some mountain, we can actually use that nuclear waste as a fuel for a fourth-generation reactor. And what is discouraging about this story, which I tell in my book, is that it was the United States that developed this technology to the point that it was really ready to build a demonstration fourth-generation reactor in 1994. But the Clinton-Gore administration caused anti-nuclear faction of the Democratic Party, which is, I think, a minority of the country, but they became so concerned about the potential that nuclear power was going to come back that they convinced President Clinton to cancel that R&D right when Argonne National Laboratory said they were ready to make a demonstration plant. And so we've almost lost our lead on that. There are now other countries, Russia, Korea, China, they're all Japan, they're all working on this fourth generation nuclear power. We still have the best experts in the world, and it's a shame that we don't take advantage of that and develop a technology that we could sell to the rest of the world. But that really changes the picture with regard to nuclear power, because it means that we've got all the fuel we need for 1,000 years. We don't have to mine uranium for centuries, because we can burn the nuclear material that was produced for weapons and the nuclear waste that has been produced by the second-generation reactors.
Well, you know, this is a fascinating story, really, because those anti-nuclear activists, and I have to say I was one.
And a lot of my friends also, but a lot of them are now changing their minds.
What lessons do you derive from this? I mean, is this a problem that illustrates a problem that you talk about a lot in your book, Storms of My Grandchildren, Jim Hansen. You talk about the problem of communicating science, of how scientists can message certain things, because I'm sure those nuclear activists thought about nuclear power in its current second-generation mode, which is has all kinds of problems of pollution, of waste, of nuclear proliferation, of weapons.
Yeah. Some of those problems will still exist. The proliferation, you must deal with that. But in order to be in the best position to do that, it's best if the United States has the most advanced technology and exerts leadership in the international community, because even if we decide to phase out our nuclear, the rest of the world is not going to do that. And if we're not on top of the technology, we're not going to be in a position to make sure there are the best possible arrangements to minimize the chance that terrorists or someone gets a hold of nuclear material. But it is, as you imply, the science community has, the public is not as well versed in the science as we would hope, and maybe we scientists are not very good at communicating.
I think you are actually wonderful at communicating in this book. We just came out of this whole ClimateGate thing where, you know, these scientists appeared to be, you know, cooking the numbers by taking certain assumptions. And you also talk in the book about how scientists themselves restrain themselves from talking about policy implications because of the nature of the scientific method. So how do you think scientists, what stance do you think they should take? How do you think they should think about this messaging issue?
Well, I think the scientific community is becoming more concerned that we do have to communicate better. It used to be frowned upon if scientists tried to communicate. I remember when Carl Sagan began speaking to the public about planetary research, that he found it harder, you know, to get along in the scientific community when he did that. But I think that attitudes are changing. Scientists realize that we have to do a better job of communicating, or the decisions made by the political process are not going to be optimum. But it's difficult, and I don't have any really good answer, except, as I say, I try to introduce a little of the science and the scientific method in each chapter, and I intend to keep updating the science on these topics on my Columbia University website, hoping this is one way to get people to understand how the scientific method works.
Yes, and we will link to that on our website as well at writersvoice.net. Well, my final questions have to do with the politics. You were the guy who actually explained climate change to Al Gore. But you write that the Clinton-Gore administration, and you've also referenced that today in this interview, you say that they were ineffectual in this matter, and you're being polite, that emissions substantially increased. What do you think happened? I mean, Gore understood this. Obama seems to also understand, and yet the talk is greater than the action here. Why?
Well, I think it's largely because of the fact that in Washington, as well as other capitals around the world, money talks, and the fossil fuel industry's got a lot of money. I'm encouraged by the fact that Al Gore, in the Copenhagen discussions, he did clearly state, I believe for the first time, made a clear statement in public that it made more sense to put a price on carbon emissions. And to use that money to return it to the public one way or another, either as a payroll tax deduction or as a dividend, as I suggest. The reason I prefer a dividend is we can then very easily see that it equals the amount that was taken in from the fee on carbon. And also half the people are not on payrolls. They're either retired or they're involuntarily out of work. But in any case, he made this clear statement, and also John Kerry, made a statement that indicated he was open-minded about that, that didn't necessarily have to be a cap-and-trade with offsets scheme. So the politics is difficult because in our democracies, it's no longer strictly a case of one person, one vote. In many cases, it's $1, one vote.
Right.
Unless we can get campaign finance reform so that we can get money out of politics, it is going to be difficult.
What do you think about the EPA regulating carbon dioxide? Do you think that that's an end run around the politics? Do you think that's going to work?
Well, it obviously is an end run, and on the short term, it can work and get us moving in the right direction. But it's not the best approach on the long run, because if we get an election and a different administration comes in, they may direct EPA in a different way. So we really need to make the fundamental changes. And as I keep repeating, but the only way to do that is to make the price of fossil fuels gradually rise so that the competition, the clean energies, and the energy efficiency can compete and take over for the fossil fuels, and we move on to a cleaner future for our children and grandchildren.
What would you say now to listeners? You know, I mean, this is the point at which I guess listeners get told that they should call their congressperson, but given that Congress, as you say, you know, is listening more to the dollar votes than the ballot votes, what do you think citizens should do?
Well, I think that next spring is the key time, because now there is this reassessment of what the international response is going to be, because nothing was decided in Copenhagen. But it was actually useful that China and the U.S. did talk together and even signed the final, agreed on this final accord, which doesn't have any clear actions in it. But it is going to depend now. The United States is going to have to decide where it is going. And I think if we can have an honest, open discussion about cap and trade with offsets versus an honest price with the funds distributed to the public, I think the public will be able to understand that if we're going to get off fossil fuels, we've got to put a rising price on that. And if the funds that are generated are distributed to the public, they'll go along with that. This is actually a trial of this has occurred in British Columbia, which is working very well. So we need to try it in the United States, I think.
Is this kind of the equal and opposite thing that happens in Alaska, where everybody gets a fossil fuel dividend?
Well, yeah, that dividend came from selling oil, but the dividend I'm talking about would come from taxing the oil and gas and coal at the mine, and that money then being distributed to the public.
So we need to come up with some kind of slogan that can say that well.
Well, the slogan I suggested was 100% dividend or fight. Because Congress, what they want to do, whenever there's a money source, they like to give it to their favorites or to invest it. They like to make decisions about investments like clean coal. That's the marketplace should make the decisions as to what technologies are going to win. If you put a rising price on carbon, then all the competitors will try to give you a lower price. And put the money in the hands of the public and let them invest it where they think is most effective, rather than where Congress wants to put it.
Well, Jim Hansen, Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. That's the book. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. There is nothing more important, I think, for us to think about, talk about, and act about.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
James Hansen is the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And here's a poem that's apropos of what we've been talking about today. It's Advice to a Prophet by Richard Wilbur. He read it for Writer's Voice last summer when we paid a visit to him in his home in Cummington, Massachusetts.
Advice to a Prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy. The lark avoid the reaches of our eye. The jack-pine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge. And every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth when that lie of tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
Richard Wilbur reading Advice to a Prophet. You can hear more of Richard Wilbur reading his poems by going to writersvoice.net. And you can also find there two of our interviews we did with writers who passed away in January. Mystery novelist Robert Parker died January 20th at his desk at home, writing. It was a fitting end for this most prolific of writers. More than 60 books emerged from his pen. Parker was best known for his mystery novels featuring Spencer, the hard-boiled detective with a sensitive heart. Writer's Voice guest host Jody Schneider talked to Robert Parker in 2005 about his Spencer novel, School Days, his life, and his writing. And also the great people's historian Howard Zinn died January 27th at the age of 87. His book, A People's History of the United States, presented an alternative view to the one most of us are taught in school. Instead of focusing on presidents and tycoons, it told history from the bottom up. Zinn spoke to Writer's Voice in 2005 about his perspective on history, war and peace, and the two sides of the American story, exploitation and idealism. You can find both interviews on writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.